Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how, I would say, our approach to consciousness, our approach to psychology, our approach to psychiatry, the approach to the human being itself is changing. It's becoming more spiritualized, and today I'll be talking to two board members of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. They are practicing therapists, or at least Diana is, and we'll be talking about metapsychiatry. So welcome, Diana and Bruce Karayofsky.
Thank you.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for inviting us on the show. Appreciate
of course.
It.
You're always my guest if you want to be on my show.
Thank you.
Let's talk about metapsychiatry, and then if we want to talk a little bit about the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, we can do that as well later. But I'm very interested because you're both so passionate about this idea of metapsychiatry, and your teacher who founded this, his name was, what was his name again?
Thomas Hora.
So, Bruce, why don't you first tell me, your orientation to Thomas Hora and psychotherapy, and then Diana can tell me her her approach to that, and then we can talk about Thomas Hora and in general. So, you want to tell me where you're coming from as far as psychotherapy and all that, Bruce?
Sure. Yes. When I met Dr. Hora, he immediately impressed me with the kind of authority that he projected, that this was someone who really knew what he was talking about. And he developed a system. He never liked the term metapsychiatry, but he could never come up with a better term. Mm-hmm. But he was very incisive at defining spiritual terms and phenomenological terms, the kinds of problems we have in life and their meaning. He developed a method of teaching that he called the two intelligent questions. The first question is, what is the meaning of my experience? And it's based on the idea that the values that we have in life, our orientation towards life, what was called by a psychiatrist, our mode of being in the world, is the basis for our experiences, for our good experiences and for our negative experiences. And by having this understanding, one is able to question whatever happens to us and find an answer that's meaningful in terms of how we think about ourselves, about life, about others. So that's
let me see if I get that. So Hora says that our mode of being, which is kind of the foundation of our personality, determines how we react in the world. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, not just how we react, but how we invite certain experiences into our life.
Oh, okay. And can we change that? Let me ask Diana then. Is that something that's changeable, or is it fixed, or how do we work with that?
Well, as Bruce said, we have to become radically sincere and at a certain point open to seeing our invalid mode of being in the world, in other words, what we suffer from. And once we understand the meaning of an experience, we then turn to what he called the second question, which is, what is what really is? And he was a psychiatrist, and he was, he was a surgeon originally, but then got his analytic certificate in individual and group at postgraduate, many years ago. So he, along with Jung, although of course Jung was older than him, he was able to take his training, at that time, of course, it was in Freudian analysis, but he had made a real study of both Eastern and Western religious, spiritual readings, and he actually studied with a Zen master in both in Japan and here in the United States. And so the what is, what really is to come to know that we are spiritual beings, and we're here to manifest love and intelligence. There, of course, the word God is, for many people, a dirty word, but he said you don't have to think of the word God. You can see that love intelligence does manifest in the world through us. So we have to be radical in our sincerity to look at our what makes us suffer, what brings these difficult issues into our life, what are the secret thoughts that we cherish. And once we really can see that and understand it, we can turn to love and intelligence and affirm what, who we really are.
So he said this before.
Does that help at all, Alan?
Yeah, no, I'm trying. I'm getting it. I'm absorbing the expanse of character and vision and awareness that this person had. I think it's, I mean, he said it before it was fashionable that we are spiritual beings. Now everybody's saying that, you know.
Well, he was way ahead of his time, and at the time, there were other people in the field who thought he was nuts.
Why did they think he was nuts?
He did receive the first Karen Horney Award, a recognition for contributions to psychiatry, for the many papers and talks that he delivered in Europe and the United States back in the 50s and early 60s. There was some recognition within the profession of his skill and knowledgeability, although he was mostly disdained because he was speaking about God in an era in which the psychotherapy profession was seeking to be recognized as being scientifically legitimate.
Right, because wasn't Karen Horney a Freudian, and wasn't Freud totally anti-God in that sense? And people were seeing psychoanalysis and psychiatry as a phenomena of the brain and not spiritual at all, right?
Oh, actually, in the early 60s, there was a journal that Dr. Hoare was part of. It was called the Journal of Existential Psychiatry, and in it, all these were the people contributing to it were theistic existentialists.
Oh, really?
So there was the people who came over from Europe, these analysts came over from Europe, they were theistically oriented, but they were marginalized by the profession because the profession was seeking to be recognized as being scientifically legitimate.
Why? Can you tell me, though, how Hora got so involved in this? Was he born that way? Or, I mean, I know
he
studied with many people, but what was, I want to ask, I guess, what was his moment of awakening?
Well, I'll explain it to you. When he was trained initially as a surgeon, and he operated, you know, on people, and he saw other surgeons operate on people.
This is in Czechoslovakia.
He observed that whether people got better after the surgery was more dependent on their attitude than it was on the procedure that was performed on them. Mm-hmm. And this led him to study psychology. Because originally he was trained simply as a surgeon. And then so he appreciated that it was the mental attitude of the individual that was the determinant of their healing.
I see.
And that's how metapsychiatry evolved. And then he isolated these, what he called the two intelligent questions. They have also a philosophic background. The first one is called the phenomenological question. In other words, what is the meaning of what's happening to me, of this experience? I got into a fight with XYZ person. How come? What's the meaning of it? What does it indicate in my thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And to color the process a little bit more, when the meaning is discovered by an individual, either on their own or with the help of the therapist, they have to really regret that they've been attached to some invalid idea. They don't blame themselves. They blame the idea that they've been associated with. Often it's inherited from our parents, our social circle, our society. So we don't blame ourselves. We simply blame ignorance. And once okay. we see the error, the invalidity, as Diana mentioned, of the way we've been approaching life and regret it, then we're ready to turn our attention and look for other ways of being.
But that's a hard thing to do, to see that our approach has been wrong. Most people hold on to the wrong position, even if they think they're wrong. They'll hold on to it because their ego is involved in their ideas, right?
Yes.
So how do you let go of something that's been so attached in your consciousness to something you've identified with?
Right, right. It is not an easy road to walk on. However, as Horror would say, you need to suffer more before you're ready to give it up. But it's for some of us, it's in a twinkling of an eye, and for others, it's a journey, we have to keep catching our thinking. Which really comes from, in the Bible it talks about this one begat that one, and that one begat this one, and on and on and on. And these ignorant ideas have come through the whole human journey in terms of coping, how to cope in this world.
Right.
But sometimes we find our coping mechanisms getting us into trouble. And at that point, we may have an opening to come to realize that maybe there's a different way of approaching life.
See, what the Horace once wrote, that change occurs the moment we see the utter futility of the approach we've been using in our life.
What about successful?
Then we're willing to open our eyes, listen to other points of view. And part of metapsychiatry was educating its patients and students in the ways of God, how to listen to God for inspiration, and the nature of God.
What about, though, our addictive pattern? I mean, so you're saying even though we have an addictive pattern, we have to suffer until we realize that that suffering is not serving us.
So there was once a time in a group where Dr. Hora, a patient said to Dr. Hora, "Look, Dr. Hora, I've been hearing this from you for a long time now. I understand what my problem is, but still, I don't get better. What could help me?" So Dr. Hora said, "Well, maybe a painful disease would be of help."
Wasn't suffering enough. What did the guy say then?
If we don't suffer enough, we're not willing to change. You're quite right that people, we get addicted to our way of being, and we assume it's right. And when we suffer from it, we say, well, I wasn't doing it right. I can do it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you deal with that with yourself? I mean, how do you work with that therapy we all have certain behaviors. How would you, work with that situation with yourself?
Well, Dr. Hora in metapsychiatry provided many, many principles and definitions that help us to understand our problems. For example, should thinking is a serious problem. This was first described by Karen Horney as tyrannical.
Yes, I agree. Yes, yes.
There's a second principle of metapsychiatry says, take no thought for what should be or what shouldn't be. Seek first to know the good of God, which already is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's guidance for us. It's saying we're suffering from wanting these things and not wanting things, and we can be content and more peaceful, attain peace, if we appreciate the good that is available to us.
But, you know, he spoke about mind fasting. And
mind fasting? You said mind?
Mind fasting.
Yes. What does that mean?
Well, for instance, I still have certain issues in terms of wanting recognition, wanting to be loved, wanting to be liked, not wanting this and not wanting that. Finally, I'm coming to a point where I can begin to look at that wanting, not act on it, and just observe it. I do understand psychologically where it comes from, you know, mm-hmm. a sense of, I don't even know the word anymore, it must be overcoming it, deprivation, let's say, a sense of deprivation, mm-hmm. and then wanting others to heal this deprivation, which, of course, others can't do, and then you get addicted on others. So mind fasting, like meditation, is watching, hopefully not reacting. And if you react, well, you got to forgive yourself and start all over again. So watching our thoughts, and hopefully coming to both understand them and see the futility of them.
I'm getting that. So it's really, I mean, Horror is really into self-observing. You have to observe yourself. You have to kind of become the spirit itself. You have to be the observing awareness mind. Is that what you're saying? Almost like a Zen approach.
He would call it the transcendent observer.
He called that the transcendent observer.
Yes.
So it's very Zen-like and Buddhist-like.
Oh, yes.
As far as understanding. So I know how long did he practice for or teach his...
He started in the late 40s and he passed away in 1995. And during all that time, he was either... In the early years, he was, you know, preparing papers and giving talks in Europe and the United States. But starting in the middle 60s or so, he abandoned the profession, so to speak, and just worked with patients. So he had many patients around the world, actually. There were people who would call into him. And he had several teachers who became, you know, disciples who became teachers of metapsychiatry in California, in Connecticut, in different places. And
it's still popular. I mean, you're both still interested in it.
I work for the foundation. There's a foundation been created back in the early 80s. It's called the PAGL Foundation, P-A-G-L. It stands for Peace, Assurance, Gratitude, and Love. And it's those are the characteristics of consciousness when it's in harmony with reality.
Mm.
And out of that, he developed the principle, don't proceed in life unless you have PAGL.
Peace, assurance,
gratitude, and love. Now, he also defined love in a way that you rarely encounter. He called it real love is non-personal, non-conditional benevolence.
I like that. He sounds like a beautiful guy. He sounds like
he was
really
fantastic.
He was enlightened in a sense.
Enlightened in many ways. I mean, he was human. He had his little foibles, but for the most part, he was extremely enlightened. He had a tremendous sense of humor. He was laughing all the time and having his patients laughing and groups laughing because he just had a brilliance about him. He always lifted my spirit whenever I had a private session with him. And he was a gem. And as a consequence, the foundation has hundreds of students around the world continuing to read his books and listen to the recordings that were made. We have a video. Well, I think you had a chance to look at it.
Yeah, some of it. I mean, a little bit. Hello?
Yes.
Ruth?
Oh. Yes.
No, so, okay, so he had this framework for metapsychiatry, and Diana, you're a therapist, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's, and how were you able to take this into the world and work with other people with these principles? What's your approach in that way?
Well, for instance, I can think of one particular patient, young woman, who had a predilection, a bright young woman in the fashion design field, and she would inevitably pick up men and have these one-night stands.
What's her number? I'm kidding.
Finally, thank God, she got married.
All right.
Oh. Took a long time.
What about that, though?
Okay, so she had a father who was an alcoholic, so we came to understand that she was looking to other men as a substitute for her father, and you know, one of the things, you know, that she would do almost immediately with these men would be have oral sex with them. And we came to understand, you know, that she really was looking for her father to, so to speak, give her a sucker. Is that the right word?
Sucker.
No. And
give her what? Saying?
Support.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but
make her feel wanted.
But there was a predilection, you know, towards practically being with a stranger and, you know, having oral sex with this man.
But was she not enjoying it, or was she doing it because she was working unconsciously for this?
No, she was trying to get a man to love her.
Uh-huh.
But they would, you know, the relationships would not last. You know, they would go south quickly and very often. So we first came to understand the meaning of her behavior. And, you know, her suffering. And I would then, you know, introduce certain of the principles that we learned from Dr. Hora. You know, one of them is the first principle is thou shalt have, it's almost like on the biblical commandments, but thou shalt have no other interest before the good of God, which is spiritual blessedness. Mm. Now, I change that into thou shalt have no other attachments beside the good of God, which is... So the attachment to these, as you used the word before, unconscious thoughts that propel us into these difficult and dangerous experiences, we are attached, as you talked about an addiction, we are attached to invalid ways of being in the world, and you're right, we do it over and over and over, and we don't even know why. We just know that at a certain point we start to suffer.
Well, we do it over and over again because we think at one point it's going to work for us. And if we keep doing it, it's going to work. I think that's why we keep doing the same behavior, because we're expecting different results, which is, of course, the definition of insanity, right? To do the same thing and expect different.
Right.
I mean, that's
but
what some people
say. But just the fact that she entered therapy as a young woman was a major step that she recognized, because she came from a highly ignorant family. So just her awareness that she needed help with this was a wonderful step, and she needed the therapeutic a good therapeutic relationship with her therapist to feel safe and understood and loved. And as I say, eventually, thank God, eventually, it took many, many years, she, finally met a wonderful man and married. And so that's one experience that I can relay.
So but I'm not getting, what was the thing that worked for her? How was she able to change that behavior?
Well, she began to see, the idea it was to begin to see the, how her thinking, her unconscious thinking was leading her nowhere, and she had to be conscious of the meaning of this behavior. So eventually, little by little, here a little, there a little, she was able to come to see that she was trying to, it's like asking what's two and two, and she keeps coming up with five.
Uh-huh.
Eventually, two and two became four.
And that's because she realized that her behavior was not getting her the results she was after.
Right. And it became like an obsession.
And it wasn't just that it wasn't getting the result that she wanted, because the problem is the result that we want is the problem.
Yeah. Right. That's a good point.
The approach that we're using, that we're interested in the wrong things. We're interested in things which don't help us to lead healthy, productive, fulfilled lives.
Right.
We need to learn healthy values also. And one of the ways that metapsychiatry works is by teaching us about healthy spiritual values like harmony, joy, generosity, goodness, humor, vitality, peace, gratitude. Speaking about those qualities of consciousness brings people to a different level of understanding. They don't look at life in so much of a material way, but they begin to consider the value of harmony, of joy, of goodness, of peace.
But it's easy to say all those things, and how do we start to live it is my question. I agree. They're great concepts, but how do we change it from theoretical into practical application?
Right. It's a cognitive process. We have to come to understand that these qualities are real, that they're significant, they're transformative, they're good.
Mm.
Unless we appreciate that they're good, it's not easy to follow them. We have to, when you understand something, then it's easy to follow that understanding. It's like when you're struggling with a problem, a math problem, or an art problem, or a music problem. You don't understand, and you work on it. Suddenly, an answer comes. It becomes clear what the right course of action or understanding is. And once you understand, everything becomes easy. But until you understand...
No, I get that.
And you
but
have
it
to
takes
suffer.
A breakthrough. Yes, there's a breakthrough that happens.
Exactly.
I have an example that I speak about. Sometimes we teach up at Columbia Teachers College with Sam Menahem. He has a class in alternative psychotherapies. And he loves me to tell this story. I had come back from visiting my son and daughter-in-law in California. And I had this pain in my shoulder. And I do a lot of good meditation and meaning work when I'm in the shower, also when I'm driving. So
why not?
I was watching this pain, and I saw that I was very angry with my son and daughter-in-law. I assessed it as a chip on the shoulder. I had a chip on the shoulder. And I realized the meaning was that I want them to recognize me, to love me, to respect me, and they should do that.
They should. That's a should, you're saying.
But then when I saw the meaning, I was able to quickly turn to the spiritual, the spiritual idea, and remember that these children are not here for me. I'm not here for them. We're all here for God. And there was a release.
What does that mean? For I don't understand that concept. What you mean? I mean, I'm just curious what you mean. It sounds good, but what do you mean we're here, all here for God?
Well, that these ideas let me just put it this way to you. He talks about, there's another principle called, there is no interaction anywhere. There's only omniaction everywhere. If you put your fingers together, that's interaction. So you're involved with somebody else's thinking, what they're thinking about, what you're thinking, what you're thinking about, what they're thinking, and you can't get out of it. It's a trap.
Right.
So so the omniaction is opening up your fingers. Vahil Gibran talks about this, and leaving a space between the two of you. But in that space, divine mind, omniactive love intelligence can begin to flow. If you're in an interaction mode, forget about it. You're lost. You're trapped.
All right. I'm just trying to understand. So omniaction is what again? I'm trying to understand the concept.
So God is omniactive love intelligence. For instance, it's a principle. It's not a person.
Omni means everywhere. So
yes.
God is acting everywhere through everything.
And the thing is, it's a principle. Like gravity, it's a principle. Divine mind, omniactive. Love intelligence is another principle. But we have to let go of this interaction thinking. Let go of what should be, what shouldn't be. What I want, what I don't want, and ask, well, what does God want?
But God wants what we want. I mean,
God wants us to glow.
But we want to glow by our egoic actions. That's how
well,
we think we glow.
That's the struggle. You know what's beautiful? We talked about and thinking about a pearl. How a pearl is made. It's made with sand rubbing together. Who knows how many years rubbing together.
It's the irritation that
beautiful white thing evolved.
Yes.
So yes, the ego struggles with the spiritual being in us, and we struggle. And I'm still struggling back and forth. I'm sure Bruce is too. And it may take
Bruce
a couple of lifetimes,
but Bruce is...
It's like the pearl with the ego and the spirit rubbing together, working against each other. But finally, a beautiful pearl emerges.
So we're all working on developing our pearl.
Hopefully.
No, we all have irritations, and we keep rubbing up against them, and I think they are. You know, I think we're all on a spiritual journey, whether we know it or not, and this form is to teach us what Horror was saying, whether we get that or not. It's here to, so we can learn. We're all evolving,
it's
I
hard
think.
To get it. As a matter of fact, Dr. Horror once said, it's not difficult to be enlightened.
Yes.
It's only difficult to be interested in being enlightened.
Well, a lot of people are now interested in being enlightened, though.
Well, whether it's genuine or not is moot, because the interest, humility has to take over.
But even if it's not genuine, I see it as at least a step upward from people who aren't interested at all, who haven't heard anything. Yes, maybe they don't really know the orientation towards a spiritual life, but at least it's better than watching the football game or something.
Yes, but there is, in other words, unless you know the truth.
But what is the truth, Bruce? What is the truth? How can we know the truth if we don't know what the truth is?
Well, we have to be interested in seeking the truth. If we're interested in it, we can find it. Dr. Hoare has one quote in the front of his book, one of his books. The meaning and purpose of life is to come to know reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a profound statement when I first encountered this. And it sort of shocked me. And I saw there were three implications to this. Number one is, if we're not interested in trying to discover what's real, what's reality, then we're somewhat wasting our lives.
Mm-hmm.
The second implication is what we take to be reality, the surface of people, physical bodies interacting in various ways, that's not reality. That's an appearance. And the third implication is that it's possible to know what is real.
Mm-hmm.
Now, metapsychiatry's definition of what is real is that there's an infinite intelligence that has established the universe, that governs the universe, that is available to those who are interested in listening to it.
I agree with that. I totally agree with that. And so how do we start to tune into that great intelligence? What process did he lay out to do that?
Well, it's an interesting thing, because Dr. Hoare, compared with other teachings, said that there is no method per se. There is no step-by-step. There are three practices: study, prayer, and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Study, where we study the writings of spiritual teachers throughout the ages, and metapsychiatry in particular, because it's so precise and clear. It's got dozens of very valuable definitions that illuminate things for us, things we never thought about. For example, when we use the word difficult or hard about doing something, it indicates that we have a conflict of interest, because what we are really interested in purely, without any contradictory thing, is a labor of love. It could be schlepping heavy burdens.
Wait, that's our ultimate interest, is to do action for love, is what you're saying.
Yes, but
that's our... Yes, I agree with that. Yes, yes, yes.
But it's not,
but,
not something we... The other thing he says about metapsychiatry, which sounds, a little crazy or, elusive, is metapsychiatry is the study of those things that cannot be done.
Yeah, explain
example,
that.
Love. We can't love, per se.
We can't
appreciate love and
be aware
of it and be interested in it. And thereby we manifest it. And harmony, similarly, and joy and generosity and humor. And as we're aware of these things, they manifest in us. And we begin, as Diana mentioned earlier, to glow with those qualities, those spiritual qualities that come from God. They're not personal, they're not ours, but we can be reflecting them insofar as our interest and our consciousness is involved with them and interested in them.
Wait, let me just absorb that quote you said. the things, say that again, is to...
Metapsychiatry is the study of those things that cannot be done.
That cannot be done. What does he mean by that, done?
It means we can't consciously say, I am going to love.
We cannot. I thought we can say that consciously.
Say it, but we have to appreciate that love, all love emanates from the infinite mind. And we can bask in that love insofar as we're aware of it. We can look out on nature, what appears to be nature, beautiful grasses and trees, you know, coming into bloom now in the springtime, and appreciate the goodness, the joyfulness, the supreme intelligence behind that. And we can just bask in appreciation and gratitude for for those things. But we're not doing it in order to do it, we're appreciating it. It's something that we receive, not something that we can...
It's not operational.
That was the term Hori used.
Operational meaning what, Diana?
There's a step-by-step procedure for following it. First,
It just has to be... we just have to expand into that, you're saying.
Yes. Focus our attention on.
It's a very Zen approach again. But again, Diana, when you work with people in metapsychiatry and you lecture on and talk about that, what is it, because we have a lot of concepts, what is it that you want people to come away with and learn and learn about themselves?
That's a good question, Alan.
Well, that's why I asked.
Well, the thing is this. I don't want anything.
Okay, but they're coming to you because they need help.
Right.
So they're coming to you, and you're there to communicate something with them, right?
Right. That's right.
Right.
And so, what happens is inspired wisdom can manifest in the room, in the conference, in the lecture. Love intelligence manifests, and there are people who have an ear for it, and there are people who don't have an ear for it, and that's okay.
I can give you one example that might be helpful. And this is something that happened with Dr. Hora, and it's written up in one of the booklets that he wrote. Mm-hmm. A man comes into his office and sits down in the chair, and he's in agony. He's writhing in pain. His back is killing him. He can barely move. And he starts to talk, and he starts to complain about his daughter, how he's very critical of his daughter, angry thoughts about her for whatever reason. And Dr. Hora sits there and listens, and suddenly the thought comes into his consciousness. He doesn't say a word, but the thought comes, nevertheless, you love her very much.
Right. I get that. Yes. Yes.
Immediately, the man jumps up and he said, what happened? What did you do? It's gone. My pain is gone. This was an example of receptivity. It was a man who appreciated Dr. Hora's wisdom and goodness and was somehow magically transformed by Dr. Hora saying, nevertheless, you love her very much.
He said that out loud?
He thought it.
And because he thought it, he shifted that person's vibration.
Right. Somehow the man was receptive and appreciative, and suddenly the pain, and this is the other thing that Dr. Hora taught, and that Diana teaches, is that the physical pains that we have, the diseases we contract, the unpleasant interactions we have with people, we invite them by entertaining certain thoughts that are not...
Or attitudes. We have certain attitudes that... Yeah, I believe that. Yeah.
So we teach... Yeah. So that's one of the things that we teach in these classes and with Diana with her patients.
About that example with the man, you have to be quite an expanded person, I think, and there are cases of gurus or teachers or spiritual teachers that emanate a field that can heal others with their thoughts. And I think he was probably evolved enough in order to emanate, it sounds like it, a field that was able to shift that person's, let's say, frequency, so the pain would heal and he could probably even forgive his daughter and, you know, expand right. That person. Yes.
But there are, I encountered, you know, similar situations. I wouldn't necessarily attribute it to an individual, but, you know, I was concerned about somebody, and then a phone call came through from somebody else, and the nature of that phone call brought me peace with regard to the individual. So it's not personal. It's the presence, the awareness of a presence of an infinite loving mind that makes available to us, if we're interested and we're receptive, elevating thoughts.
But if I agree. Yeah, I think someone, though, who is in that awareness, not as a possibility, but is living that, also emanates a bigger field to help other people get into that space.
Yes, they can be a blessing.
And it sounds like Horror was that.
Oh, yes, but he was a teacher, a wonderful teacher as well.
So you two met at one of Horror's classes? Is that the idea?
Exactly. Diana introduced me to Dr. Horror. She had been seeing him, and we met at work. We were working in a psychiatric rehabilitation center, and whatever, we were talking about various things. I mentioned the Buddhist teacher I had encountered in California, and she said, well, you might enjoy talking with Dr. Horror. So I went to see him, and I was blown over. He was just amazing. And
Diana, how did you meet Dr. Horror?
Well, I started to see him when I was 19. Mm-hmm. And I had an aunt we had an experience of my uncle's girlfriend's daughter about my age who committed suicide. And my aunt, Michelle, was seeing Dr. Horror, and she observed, I wasn't really aware, but she observed that I was depressed. And so she talked my parents, my mother and stepfather, into letting me go to Dr. Horror, which, when I think back, is truly an amazing thing that they allowed that and they paid for it. So I started to see him, and I always tell the story of after seeing him maybe, I don't know, once or twice, something like that, I had this dream that I was drowning and a bridge overhead was burning. But a voice came out, and to me it was like the voice of God, who said I would be okay. So that was my first dream, working with Dr. Horror. So obviously I did feel my bridges were burning and that I was drowning. And obviously seeing him, it brought it into consciousness that I was in trouble. And so
and
I
so
began
that dream,
my journey with him at age 19. And although I sound very young on the phone, I just turned 70. So
I don't believe that.
It's been a long journey.
No, and so,
and but in between, I've had some wonderful experiences, but one of which is I had wanted to become a social worker. There was someone in our family who was, and so eventually I did all my college work as an adult. I did not go to college after high school. I worked. So eventually, as an adult, I got my BA and then credits in psychology, and then entered into social work school, and then entered into psychoanalytic training. But Hora was not happy about my going this route.
Why? You must. I mean,
that was very difficult for me.
Why was he not happy about that?
Well, I think he had a sort of old-fashioned idea that social workers were do-gooders. And anyway, so I went into it, so to speak, ass backwards, because he was a father figure to me, and if he wasn't approving, that was a really tough thing for me to go against. But I wound up, my training was very much in the area of what's called object relations, the English object relations, and I learned a tremendous amount, because the one thing I could say for me with Dr. Hora was he didn't really go into the past, and I think that there is there needs to be recognition of past wounds, not necessarily to dwell on it, but the recognition of, let's say, the wounded child. This is what I learned in my analytic trainings. So I actually veered away for a while from metapsychiatry and immersed myself in these object relations and training and really loved it. When Henry Grayson began the Center for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, this is back in like 1999, I heard about a meeting he was having and reluctantly went to the meeting. And I was blown away by Henry. And Henry was the founder of the National Institute for the Psychotherapy's Training Institute. But he had had an awakening, a spiritual awakening, began to believe that we needed to integrate spirituality and psychotherapy. So at that meeting, I must have said a few things, and he or somebody came over to me and asked, did I want to, you know, join in on this new organization. So slowly but surely, I became involved, and then we turned into, so I was able to both have my metapsychiatric learning, but also the psychodynamic understanding. And I put the two together, and I think that has been a blessing, not only for myself, but in helping others.
Wait, talk about how you put the two together, how it looked like when you,
I understood with object relations, I understood the writings of Fairbairn and Harry Guntrip and Winnicott.
Who are those people?
They're prominent, I'm not sure, a British, I don't know if you would call them psychiatrists. I'm not sure if they were I'm pretty sure they probably were psychiatrists at that point, who wrote. There are a number of books that they've written, but what they came upon was that the child, if they took about an object, the object relations, in that you internalize the object, the prominent object, your mother, your father. That's what I mean. You internalize because they're your God. You see. When we're young, our parents are our God. Whether they be a good God or a bad God, they become our God. And Dr. Hora talked about parental fantasies, that we incorporate into ourselves our parents' fantasies about themselves and about us. And that can be, now if you have wonderful parents, it could be great. But if you have pretty ignorant parents, you know, it can be devastating.
So that influences a lot of our behavior, our parents' psychic,
absolutely.
I would call it.
Absolutely. But of course, you have to realize when they grew up as little children and interjected from their parents. That's what I mean by in the Bible.
I know, but how do we free ourselves from all of that?
You know, right from Eve and
but how do we? How did Hora say we get rid of?
But
how do we get rid of the whole thing? How did Hora say? Are we able to just free ourselves from the whole?
First, you have to recognize it. He talks about the three R's: recognition, regret, and reorientation. You have to come to recognize that it doesn't have to be this way.
See, some people try to use a spiritual bypass. They even
what does that mean?
Path. For example, several years ago, a Zen Buddhist master, actually, long-term student of Zen, visited a psychologist who was trained in Zen Buddhism and spoke with him because he had many problems that he had sort of buried. Because if you don't deal with the meaning of your problems and you just try to go to the spiritual truth, you're bypassing issues that will corrupt your experience and your life. So you have to get at the truth. And that's why the two intelligent questions are such a wonderful method. They're so incisive. And they're also contrasted by Dr. Hora with the six dumb questions.
Six dumb questions? Tell us.
What's wrong? How do you feel? Why did this happen?
Those are questions we should never ask, you're saying.
Right, because they are not productive. They have various negative aspects to them.
That makes sense.
They don't really lead to answers. Whereas asking the meaning of our problem, that leads to examining what we value, what's important to us. Because what's important to us is what's going to be coming out in our lives. It's part of the reason Dr. Hora wouldn't bother with the past. You can look at the present. Because in the present, you have those values. Now, you could say, I got them from my parents 50 years ago, but it doesn't matter. It's the fact is you're hanging on to ideas that are troublesome.
Well, but I believe that the wounded child has to be recognized and understood. And so I think that's an important piece. That needs to be validated, but, that there was trauma.
But how come Hora didn't value that if you're valuing it, Diana? Why? But would he say that that wounded child is present in the wounded adult? Would that be his theory?
Yes.
Right.
It isn't. Either you've transcended it, or if you haven't transcended it, it would be present in your consciousness and it would be manifested in certain activities that you experience or experiences that you have. So that it becomes clear, you know, in the course of therapy, it comes out what, you know, that it's present, these invalid ideas to which one is attached.
Uh-huh. So how do you get to the root of it? Diana's root could go back to the past. I mean, that approach
go
back.
It's not a matter of going back to the past. It's a matter of recognizing from where the suffering came from. Understanding that, and somehow coming to peace. You know, at a certain point in my life, I had a very, very difficult relationship with my stepfather, really tough. And at one point, I was having a really terrible back pain, and Hora would say that back pain is about the past. And I remember lying on the floor, the awareness came to me that I needed to forgive. His name was Mac. I needed to forgive Mac. I never, ever thought that before. Never. And I came to not only forgive him, but I came, and he had passed a long time before, to forgive him. And to appreciate him, what he did for my mother with her two children. Mm-hmm. And he did the best he could do under the circumstances. So that was miraculous.
Did that clear up your back pain?
It did. But more importantly, I feel compassion for this man, and I could cry thinking about it. And I hated him.
You hated him. Do you mind telling me why you hated him so much?
Well, first of all, my mother, you know, back then, mm-hmm. you didn't divorce. And my mother divorced my father.
I was
probably around five. And then they took us away from the Lower East Side, where I had my whole family, especially my grandmother and grandfather and others who took care of me. And so we moved away, and then they had a baby. So I have a half brother, and he was tough. He was a tough guy, really tough.
But you resented the fact that there was probably nothing he was actually doing. It was what you were putting on him.
Well, I think it always takes two to tango. But
an early
memory, interesting enough, when we were still living on the Lower East Side, was I remember putting on these, remember they had these like jogging pants. That you go into the snow with, but they were tied around the... And he bought them, and they must have been drying on the
radiator.
On the radiator, and it burnt me so. And this is like symbolic of the pain for me of losing my father, and this new stranger comes into our life.
Oh.
And it was tough. It was tough.
But you were able to forgive that eventually because you saw...
Much, much later on in my life.
But you were doing something. You realized he did the best he could, and you were laying some kind of trip from your ego personality onto the situation. Is that what...
Well, but don't forget I was a child at the time that this happened. And
right.
I grew up with him in terms of becoming a teenager and all of this. So, who could appreciate what he was doing? And there's more to it than that.
I'm sure there's more to it. But so, I mean, I'm trying to get a good sense of metapsychiatry and Horace teaching in a way, and mm-hmm. seeing how maybe people listening could apply some of that to their lives. I mean, what do you suggest?
Well, one thing I wanted to make sure of to say is Cora would say we suffer from what we cherish, what we hate, and what we fear. Mm-hmm. So you could start off looking at that because generally what we cherish gets us into trouble. For instance, I may cherish a chocolate ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
It's
to excess.
You know, that leads to weight gain and all those issues. But what we cherish, what we hate, and what we fear. So our mind is preoccupied with these three issues. So we could mm-hmm. begin to look at that. If I'm suffering, what am I cherishing? What am I hating? And what am I fearing?
And what I would suggest for people listening who would like to understand more is to go to the PAGL website, pagl.org, and look under, I think the caption would be The Works, and there's a DVD, and they can watch that DVD online. It's about an hour, and it has the experiences of many, many of the students of metapsychiatry and how they were blessed by the understanding communicated by the teaching, and specifically Dr. Hora, if they knew Dr. Hora. Some of them were newer and only studied with students of Dr. Hora. But
it sounds great. I mean, what I'm getting from this conversation is that he was really a bridge, and like you said, between a spiritual approach to problems and situations and a psychiatric practical approach. I mean, that
yes.
He
yes, it's very practical. mystical.
Yes. He created his own school of thought in that way.
Because, for instance, if you find yourself thinking about what somebody else is thinking about, what you're thinking about, and you have this repetitive, ruminating thinking going on, you can turn to one of the principles. There is no interaction anywhere. There's only omniaction everywhere. You know, I think about it like falling out of a boat and someone throws you one of these, a lifeline. If you can turn your attention to one of the principles, and there are 11 principles, and meditate on the principle, turn your attention to the principle, that could be very helpful to waking you up from the dream. Because most of us are in a dream and or a nightmare.
Yeah, it's one of the most accessible books for reading of Dr. Hora to gain a better understanding. It's called Beyond the Dream, and it's available through Amazon.
What does it talk about, Beyond the Dream?
Print on demand.
What does he talk about in that book?
By Thomas Hora.
Yeah, what is it? How do you spell Hora?
H-O-R-A, like the dance.
And what does that book particularly talk about?
It talks about 58 different subjects. It's 58 chapters. They're all different. They're on every subject from time to sex to protection, every subject imaginable. As a matter of fact, the whole range of Dr. Hora's books cover every imaginable topic that you could think about that anyone would bring to a psychotherapist.
Well, I think this has been a really good introduction to Dr. Hora's work. What was his first name, Dr.?
Thomas
Hora?
H-O-M-A-S.
Right. And just one last question. You're both on the board of the ASP, Association for Spirituality Psychotherapy. How have you been able to bring metapsychiatry into ASP?
We've taught it for many years. We used to have, there was a one-year program in which we would teach a module on metapsychiatry. It was always extremely well-received by all the students. We've been teaching it as the last half dozen years with Sam Menahem at Columbia Teachers College. It's just a one-night, 2-hour session. But it's always very well-received because the students write a reaction paper. And they find it, it's unusual, it's different, and it's very refreshing, it's very precise. But it's really a matter of confronting your situation, and most people are not willing to do so.
I just wanted to say one more thing. When we would have conferences, the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, and we drew 300 to 400 people, our first one was at NYU, I introduced Dr. Hora's book to Henry Grayson. And when he read the book, he had a very high regard for Hora. And then when we sold all kinds of psycho-spiritual books at the conferences, Hora's books would be there. That really meant so much to me that Henry regarded this man. In addition, when Ken Wapnick, who recently passed away, may he rest in peace, who was a very big individual in Course in Miracles, he said the teachings of Hora come the closest to A Course in Miracles. So Hora was highly regarded, by the
spiritually oriented therapists.
Yeah, so.
Oh, sorry, I lost you for a second. You said the teachings of Hora comes the closest to what?
The Course in Miracles.
The Course in Miracles.
Oh. So, if you wanted to leave this, people with one kind of thought, though, that they could work with. I know some of you've been throwing this out there, but how can people use a little piece of metapsychiatry in their own lives right now?
Well, I can mention two statements from the principles. One is nothing comes into experience uninvited, and problems are lessons designed for our edification.
I see. So he sees, I'm just trying to get a sense, he sees life as for us. Everything that we encounter is for our spiritual evolution, whether we like it on a personality ego level or not. Would he say something like that?
Yes. Yes, it's meaningful. Everything that happens to us is meaningful, and it indicates the values that we cherish. But it's for learning. If it's an unpleasant experience, it's there for us to learn from it. Because when we're in harmony with reality, the way the world works, with life, then things proceed appropriately. They proceed smoothly, effortlessly. The three E's, effortlessly, effectively, and efficiently.
And when we're not in harmony, the universe is working with us to be in harmony, so things come up in order to redirect our course to harmony. Is that the idea?
Well, no. When we have an unpleasant experience, a difficult experience, it's indicating to us that we're not in harmony with the way the world works, and we need to turn our attention and look and learn. But the specific lesson to be learned is unique to each individual in each circumstance.
So he is saying that the universe is for us. Everything we encounter is for our growth and evolution.
Yes.
Well, I like that. Yes.
He would also talk about there's either the sea of mental garbage, or what's the?
The ocean of love intelligence.
We're either dwelling in the ocean of love intelligence or the sea of mental garbage.
I like
that.
And
we can look at that and ask ourselves, well, where am I? Am I in the sea of mental garbage or the ocean of love intelligence?
He also said, my favorite quote, what I've heard you talk about before, is that every problem is emotional, every solution is spiritual. Is that what he said? Something like that?
Every problem is psychological.
Oh,
solutions
right.
are spiritual.
I like that, because he must have had some great awakening where he knew we were on this greater spiritual path. I mean, I get a sense he must, I mean, from just what you're saying, but also, you know, the ideas he left behind, that he had a huge perspective. He knew who he was on a spiritual level of awareness.
Absolutely.
Well, it's exciting.
In fact, Alan, one more thing. He would talk about the four W's. And when you asked before about, you know, what I do in therapy, it's what I don't do. It's what I know. And when you talk about the four ways of asking yourself, who am I, what am I, where am I, and what is my purpose? So that's important ideas to meditate on. The four W's.
That's good. Who am I, what am I, where am I, and what is my
purpose? And what is my purpose?
So anyone in any kind of situation, any conflict, they should ask them, but they might want to ask themselves.
On the website, Pagel.org, there are booklets they can download for free and read. There's some audio tapes that have been putting up. We'll be putting up a whole bunch more. And then there are books that can be purchased through Amazon.
And there's a concordance with every word or idea that's in all of his books, and you go to the concordance, let's say you bring up depression, look for depression, it's alphabetical. It will talk about depression and what he would have to say about it, anxiety,
headache,
you name it. It's there in the concordance.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and explaining Dr. Hora's work, because, you know, without you and other people, this valuable contribution would be lost in a way.
Yeah.
And so
we were blessed.
You were blessed, and you're also spreading the power of these ideas.
Yes, they're very helpful.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Diana. I'll send you the MP3 of this, and the website again is pagl.org?
Correct.
And, of course, you can also find Diana and Bruce associated with asphealing.org, the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy.
And we
Diana,
do have a website also, meaningandtruth.com.
Oh, that's your website, Diana and Bruce? Being and Truth.
Yes. Meaning and Truth.
Oh, Meaning and Truth. All right. Thank you. So, I'm happy we had the conversation because now I understand a little bit more about you two.
Thanks so much for inviting us on your show. It means a lot to us.
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks for sharing. I get that this teaching and this way of being is meaningful and it can help people. So thank you for sharing that. So,
thank you, Alan. And I hope your audience found it helpful.
Okay. And of course, this will then be on the ASP website, ASP Healing website. And you could use this anywhere you want. And also, of course, BBS Radio, the host of the show, we can find it there. And also, I'll put it on my website, newrealities.com. Okay, I'll talk to you two soon, like the next day or so, okay?
Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye, Alan.
Thank you both. That's Bruce and Diana Kiriewski on metapsychology, the teachings and psychological approach by Dr. Thomas Hora. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me or contact me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. You can also go to my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening, and good night.